news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all, it is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad as always to be getting back behind the microphone, getting into gear, and going in pursuit of the truly anomalous aspects of our existence as we do. Listen on demand via podcasting apps throughout all of space and time, available in every pocket, and of course, via our station affiliates at the UNX Radio Network. Lots to get into this week, as always. Hope you guys are having a fantastic one, and that the summer heat isn't getting you down too badly. You know, something else was hot in the skies over Texas recently, a fireball of some kind. Lots of folks in the southern states probably seeing this. Also, big news from the Pentagon in the ever-evolving, never-ending story of the military's interest in UAP. That's right, we have a new name, folks, for this UAP investigative office, and I'll give you all the details here shortly. And in fact, also, we have heard a lot from congressmen and women in recent days about this. I'll tell you what a few of them had to say at a recent symposium. And then a bit later, turning our attention to Earth's lonely satellite, the moon, and its many mysteries. For centuries, there have been strange things observed by astronomers on the lunar surface. So what's really going on up there? There's been a lot of speculation about that, and in a few instances, actually, there may have been some novel observations of things around the moon that are worthy of further consideration, especially considering now that we have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter up there, which is able to get these incredibly high-resolution images of the lunar surface. A lot of scientists in recent years have been saying, hey, you know, now might be the perfect time to take a closer look. Let's see what we might find up there. There could be things hidden away right there on Earth's moon that would surprise many of us. And trust me, these days when it comes to studying strange phenomena off-planet, things that are happening up there on the moon or in space in general, I just say expect the unexpected. Although one thing you might be able to expect, in truth, is in the days ahead at this fantastic conference I'm going to be giving a keynote lecture at, the Midwest Conference on the Unknown, Strange Tales 2022, which is coming up this August 5th through the 7th. I'm going to be giving the keynote speech on Saturday night. And this might actually, ladies and gents, turn out to be one of the most comprehensive lectures I've ever given on the subject of UAP. And in fact, the title of that talk is going to be Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, Past, Present, and Future Potentials. But you know, as a dedicated 4TN, I also want to go back into the history of this subject, hence part of the title being Past, right? And I want to look at the way that we have looked at space, the way we have looked at the idea of extraterrestrial life, and concepts that were sort of predecessors to the modern discussion about UAP. And that's one reason I'm so excited about this event, because folks like Michael, Ryan Sprague, and I, who are going to be there in attendance and giving talks, we all kind of see the importance of understanding the history of the UAP subject, and we actually discussed a little of the history not only of that topic, but also the history of this conference that we're all going to be attending here in the days ahead on Ryan's Somewhere in the Skies podcast over the weekend. In fact, here is what Michael Huntington had to say about how this entire idea of a Midwest conference on the unknown came to be.
First, before we even get to the event, how did it come to be? This is going to be the inaugural festival that I know you're one of the co-organizers on. Give us the skivvy, man. How did this come to be? And tell us a little about what the event is going to entail, if you don't mind.
I was approached by a friend of mine that I've known for 30 years, Ken Murphy. He's a local, conference organizer. He's in the events business, and he had been interested in bringing the sort of stuff that I'm interested in, you know, paranormal, UFOs, ghosts, Bigfoot, anything anomalous, and anything that pushes us in different directions of thinking when it comes to what constitutes, science, methodology, paradigm shifts, all that sort of stuff. We looked and saw that, the Midwest is a good place. There's not a lot of conferences in this area. People are sort of interested in this subject. from recent years, you know, within the society, within the culture, these topics have taken off in all different kinds of media. And I began reaching out and contacted some of the best speakers, I think, in different areas that, you know, can provide a, you know, a really good conversation, a really good, you know, traditional type conference that they used to have, you know, where it was, you know, people interacting, you know, it's not just everybody's up on a stage and then everybody's over here. You know, I think we're going to have just as many, you know, talented researchers and people within these different fields of inquiry within the audience, just as well as there will be on stage. But, you know, we reached out to, you know, you guys and, you know, some people within, the cryptozoological communities and, you know, people that are really bringing their A game and, trying to deal with these questions in a critically thinking manner, you know, so that we can try to work towards strategies to try to, you know, get some real answers. I think we got a good little group here.
I certainly happen to agree, and I do want to remind you, if you guys out there are nearby, or if you're willing to get out and do a little summer travel and you want to come to this fantastic event, you can learn all about it at cape-events.com. And when you're checking out, if you want to buy tickets, if you use the VIP code HANKSVIP, that will get you a whopping 30% off of your ticket cost. So indeed, I hope to see some of you guys there and that you'll be able to join us at the Midwest Conference on the Unknown Strange Tales 2022. And I tell you, something I would love to do, if we can work it out, is maybe do a nighttime sky watch from there at the event. Because you never know what's going to show up in the night sky. That was certainly the case for folks down there in Texas in recent days, who said that they saw a fireball streaking through the skies over south central Texas on Sunday night. According to local news source KSAT, they say a bright light that was seen over south central Texas on Sunday night was also spotted in Oklahoma, as well as in Louisiana, but they say that many people who saw it, or are barely seeing videos and pictures of it on Monday morning, are all wondering what in the world was that. Some said they thought it might have been space junk falling from Earth's atmosphere, but according to the American Meteor Society, they say it wasn't space junk, not a piece of falling debris that's been up there in Earth orbit for a while. No, they said this one was just a fireball, in other words, a large meteor. But according to the American Meteor Society, they say that they received more than 200 reports from people in those three states aforementioned. Apparently, more people in Texas said that they saw this, but it appears that the fireball entered the atmosphere over Cistern, which is about an hour east of San Marcos. Despite that, plenty of people in Oklahoma and Louisiana also saw this really vivid fireball. They say that the actual space rock in question, which presumably burned up in the atmosphere, they say it was about the size of a small car prior to entering Earth's atmosphere. The reason for the brightness, though, was the extreme velocity at which these objects strike the atmosphere. Again, one has to wonder, though, in the event that one of these things that's large enough to make its way close to Earth, either to make an impact or close enough to explode over the Earth, and then, of course, resulting in a Tunguska-style blast like what we saw over Siberia back in 1908, if and when that happens, I mean, this is going to be really bad news for whoever is unlucky enough to be below where that blast occurs. And so that's one more reason I'm really glad that NASA and other space agencies around the world are really leading in the effort to try and improve our detection of near-Earth objects that might be potentially deadly. But while NASA and its partners are trying to detect near-Earth objects that could prove to be dangerous one day, the Pentagon is looking for something different in the air right now. They're trying to detect different objects, very different indeed. And that's why they have now announced the establishment of what they have called the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. That's right, they have now given a new name to the forthcoming DoD UAP investigative effort, no longer going to be called the Airborne Object Identification Management and Synchronization Group, otherwise known as AMSOG. No, they've now called it AARO. Hey, I actually like that, although the name is still a little clumsy, isn't it? All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. Now, of course, we reported on this in recent days over there at thedebrief.org. I'll have the entire report that we offered about this linked in the show notes. And also a quick kudos to the fine folks over there at The Anomalist who linked to our articles. You guys are always welcome to link back to our reporting there at The Debrief. But I want to quote from the actual statement that was released last week by the Pentagon about this, where they note that on July 15, 2022, Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks, in coordination with the Director of National Intelligence, amended her original direction to the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security by renaming and expanding the scope of, and by the way, this is interesting, they say the Airborne Object Identification and Management Group, AOIMSG. Note that they left out the word synchronization. Did you see that? Did anybody else catch that? The Pentagon themselves could not even spell the former name of this outfit. They left out a word in their official statement where they're announcing the new name, the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, or AARO. I mean, come on, really, guys. But in truth, I'm not surprised. This is what we've been trying to tell you, folks. The name was clunky at best. The statement went on to read that the AARO will serve as the authoritative office of the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, that is UAP, and UAP-related activities for the DOD, that according to a memorandum released by Kathleen Hicks that preceded the announcement. Now, they called the AARO the DOD focal point for all UAP and UAP-related activities, saying that the newly renamed office may represent for the department such activities to the interagency, Congress, media, and public in coordination with the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Legislative Affairs and Assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. Any DOD component acting on behalf of the UAPTF or who has data, analysis, contracts, or other material related to UAP will immediately synchronize their efforts with the AARO. Or as Ryan, Michael, and I during the live stream last night for Ryan's program decided, we're just going to call it Aero, but I'm pretty sure everybody's doing that already. But something else that was fairly noteworthy about this new announcement about the establishment of the Aero was that with this announcement, they also, I think for the first time, the DOD publicly named Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick as being the man who's going to lead this effort. Now, that information had already been leaked by Doug Johnson, who's an independent researcher and who had written about this over at his blog back in May. Citing multiple executive branch sources, all of whom spoke on background, he was pretty sure Sean Kirkpatrick was going to be the guy to lead this effort. And just to give a little of his background, since 2012, Kirkpatrick has served as the Defense Intelligence Officer for Scientific and Technical Intelligence. He also has fulfilled the role as the DOD's counterpart to the National Intelligence Manager for Science and Technology. That he did until 2016. Kirkpatrick also served on special assignment to the Principal Deputy Director of National Intelligence and went on to serve in several other positions, which included Deputy Director of Intelligence with U.S. Strategic Command, Director of National Security Strategy with the National Security Council, and Deputy Director of Intelligence and the DNI Representative for, you guessed it, U.S. Spacecom. Long story short, what we're trying to tell you, folks, is that Dr. Kirkpatrick is more than qualified for this position. Although I've also heard from folks that under his direction, the Aero is probably not going to be looking back at historical accounts. In fact, from what I'm gleaning from what people in the know are saying, Dr. Kirkpatrick really doesn't seem to want to have very much to do, even with more recent iterations of UAP investigations within government, like the UAP Task Force. He wants to kind of distance himself from that and start now and move forward. In other words, collect the best data that we can on new sightings using the best equipment and try to understand exactly what we are looking at going forward, not from looking backward. Another key takeaway, though, also with the announcement of the establishment of the Aero, and I want to quote again from the official Pentagon statement the other day. They noted that the mission of the Aero will be to synchronize efforts across the Department of Defense and with other U.S. federal departments and agencies to detect, identify, and attribute objects of interest in or near military installations, operating areas, training areas, special use airspace, and other areas of interest, and they say as necessary, to mitigate any associated threats to safety of operations and national security. This includes, they note, and this is key, anomalous unidentified space, airborne, submerged, and transmedium objects. And this was certainly interesting, not surprising, but very interesting that they are specifically referencing underwater phenomena related with UAP activity. Objects that seem to be able to come out of water or go into it, effectively what have been termed in recent years as transmedium objects. There is, of course, also discussion about this new Aero Executive Council. This has been part of the plan for the new government UAP office going all the way back to the Gillibrand Amendment last year. And, of course, this was also going to be part of the AIMSOG effort, that there would be an executive council that was going to provide oversight. And some of the things that it's going to be helping Aero with include surveillance, collection, and reporting of UAP data. They're also going to be looking at system capabilities and design, presumably talking about designing equipment that would be useful in detecting and collecting information about UAP. Also intelligence operations and analysis, mitigation and defeat, governance, science, and technology. All these things effectively falling under the purview of that new executive council. But you know, in recent days, we also had legislation almost perfectly coinciding with this because, you know, there was a recent amendment that was passed through the House Intelligence Committee that included some additional language related to UAP. I'll now quote from that, and I think this is House Resolution 8367, where it notes that for the period beginning on January 1947 and ending on the date on which the Comptroller General completes activities under this subsection, the bill calls for the compiling and itemization of a complete historical record of the intelligence community's involvement with unidentified aerospace undersea phenomena. That's right. So in other words, while the aero under the DOD may not be looking back in time, Congress is certainly trying to legislate wording related to UAP for inclusion in the 2023 fiscal year National Defense Authorization Act that absolutely will be focusing on the history of this subject. And again, it's probably no surprise that they say for the period beginning on January 1947 and ending on the date on which the Comptroller General completes activities in this subsection. Yeah, why would they say beginning in 1947? Not a typo. No, it seems pretty obvious they're going all the way back to Roswell. But you know, I was talking recently with Chrissy Newton from The Debrief about the Roswell incident. She had asked, you know, what are your thoughts about this? What does it all mean? And as I've said in the past on episodes that we've done about Roswell, I'm not so sure that that is the UFO smoking gun that many researchers, especially in the 1980s and 90s, thought it was. If you guys recall, we actually talked about this coinciding with the 75th anniversary in recent days, and I noted how asking Kevin Randall, probably the greatest living Roswell researcher today, and I asked him during the interview that we did a couple of years back, you know, Kevin, where is the evidence for extraterrestrials? When critics ask you that, what do you tell them? And he said, you know, you're right, we have to admit that we don't have that evidence, but he also says he doesn't buy the mogul balloon theory as an explanation for the entirety of what people claim that they recognize as the Roswell UFO incident. Now, again, while I'm a little more skeptical about that, based on what I think that the evidence points to the strongest, that indeed there was a cover-up, but there's a lot more data that was made available in the 1990s than there had been available to Roswell researchers from 1980 going forward, right? I nonetheless maintain that, hey, if the modern UFO era, as we know it, began in 1947, what the language in that proposed bill outlines is not a bad idea. I would like for there to be a historical review going back to the dawn, I guess, of the modern UFO era, effectively 1947, and that summer with the sighting by Kenneth Arnold and everything else that was happening around that time. No, that's actually a really good idea, in my opinion, and I applaud Representative Gallagher and others who have been leading in that effort. And speaking of congressmen and women who have been doing just that, in recent days, we actually had a couple of members of Congress, U.S. Representative Andre Carson, who you'll recall oversaw the recent House hearings on UAP, and then also the rather bombastic Representative Tim Burchett of Tennessee. That's right, the two of them actually appeared remotely, I believe, at this year's Mutual UFO Network Symposium held in Denver over the weekend. Unfortunately, I missed that one, but for those of you who weren't able to attend, again, hopefully we'll see you in Cape Girardeau the weekend of August 5th, 6th, and 7th. But nonetheless, they had a couple of congressmen there in attendance at this MUFON event, and here's essentially what a few of them said. We'll start with Andre Carson, who said in this pre-recorded video that he sent for the lecture, "I share your goal of learning all we can about unidentified aerial phenomena. You know, unfortunately, when these issues were discussed in the past, they weren't taken too seriously, and too often treated with a stigma that many have worked hard to get past." Carson went on to say during this pre-recorded segment for the event that, "I'm proud to have led our efforts in the House Intelligence Committee to study these phenomena and bring light and new information that was ignored for too long. We've finally begun the process to take this issue very seriously. From the Defense Department to NASA, government officials have started to really investigate and begin discussing these phenomena. Some of this work will remain classified in the interest of national security, but I've been committed to opening up this work to the public." Carson went on to say, "I recently chaired the first public hearing on UAP, and testimony received was a good foundation for the work we'll continue in the months ahead. I look forward to working with all of you, advocates and activists like yourselves, who have paved the way." Now, Carson wasn't the only one to provide his thoughts at the MUFON event in Denver. He also was joined by Representative Tim Burchett of Tennessee, who appeared via Zoom, who said the following, "Our federal government is now becoming more vocal on this subject and taking more action to address the many reports coming from members of our military about UAP encounters or UFO encounters. Our federal government should absolutely become more open and transparent about what they know about UFOs. However, it seems to me that our federal government is merely attempting to appear transparent about this without actually providing useful information about what they really know. Instead of giving us helpful information, they're pumping out useless reports and bogus hearings. They're doing little to destigmatize the UFO reporting process in our military. So apparently Burchett isn't as impressed with what the military's been up to in recent days. But in truth, I think that thanks to the work of guys like him, as well as Representative Carson, Senator Gillibrand, Senator Rubio, and many others, we are definitely making some headway when it comes to getting to the bottom of the UAP issue, or at very least, getting lawmakers in Washington aware of the problem, primarily having to do with transparency. Even if the military is going to be tight-lipped and they're going to be selective about what they look at and what they allow the public to see, maybe if we continue to pressure our elected officials and let them know that this is an important issue to the American people, maybe they will indeed continue going to bat, and we will therefore continue to see legislation aimed at looking at this issue very seriously and also more comprehensively. And indeed, the history should not be left out of that equation. That would kind of be like making an apple pie or saying you're going to and then leaving out the apples, right? I mean, come on, if you want success, sometimes it does help to follow a recipe. And in my case, that recipe entails every single morning tearing open a pack of, you guessed it, Athletic Greens and adding that to a glass of water to give my body a much-needed and very well-deserved mineral and vitamins boost that helps set my energy right and really helps to propel me through the entire day. Now, some of you guys out there may be asking, you know, what exactly is this stuff? Well, let me tell you, one delicious scoop of Athletic Greens that you add to a cup of water in the mornings is going to help you absorb 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens that are going to help you start your day right. And I got to tell you guys, I'm not the only person who thinks so. For example, you know, Ed wrote to me recently, and he said that after he heard me talking about it on the show he subscribed, and this is what he wrote. He said, "I must tell you, it works as advertised. Into my second month, it has given me what I would consider natural organic energy. It's not like a quick hit of energy that causes the inevitable crash hours later. It gives me sustainable all-day energy and helps power me through the days where I run twice or I log lots of miles on the bike. And as a result," he says, "I do sleep very well at night. So thank you for your endorsement and taking me to AG." And indeed, I'd love for all you guys to try it because, again, tons of people take multivitamins and supplements out there. They're looking for high-quality ingredients, and they're really willing to pay a lot for them. Well, you're not going to pay that much for AG1. It's a great micro-habit, but you're actually going to spend less but get all of the vitamins and supplements that your body needs. Now, listen, right now it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with the convenient daily nutrition that AG1 provides. And to make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. As you know, all you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Micah. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/MICAH. athleticgreens.com/Micah to take ownership over your health and pick up what is, hands down, the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. All right. With our news now out of the way, it's time to shift our attention over to the mysteries of the moon. You ever just stared up at the moon on a clear night and wondered, what if? I know I have. And over the next few segments, we're going to be shifting our attention in the direction of those what ifs and what we have learned about the mysteries of the moon, strange structures, and much more await when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Strange flashes of light seen from the surface of the moon. Now, what would cause something as anomalous as that? Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. And this is a long-standing favorite of mine. Strange luminous phenomena observed on the surface of the moon There might have been a bit of an update, in fact, about what could cause such things in recent days, because, you know, back in June, China had actually announced the detection of high-pressure minerals in the lunar regolith samples that were collected by its Chang'e 5 lunar exploration mission. And although what this points to is impact ejecta near the craters, and it's telling us about the crater formation, I suspect that there's actually clues provided in this sample to something very unusual that's been observed on the moon for a long time. And I'll have more to say about that in a moment, but first, here's a bit of background. As China's sample return mission right now, this is actually its fifth lunar exploration effort. The Chang'e 5 has detected minerals, according to the state-run Global Times, that include two varieties, stishovite and sefertite, the latter of those having never been found before in samples from anywhere outside of Earth, that according to the Times. They also noted, however, that silicon dioxide and silica glass were also found in those samples, and that based on heat and pressure application that they used to try and simulate the conditions of an impact with these samples, the scientists were able to narrow down where they think that the samples containing the silicon dioxide debris might have come from. And that, to me, is indeed one of the most interesting sampling areas that the Chang'e 5 probe has looked at, and that is the Aristarchus crater. Now, longtime listeners of the program might actually know why I'm so interested in the Aristarchus crater. It's one of the brightest features visible on the lunar surface in its northwestern corner of its Earth-facing side. And the crater itself is actually the result of an impact that left a hole in the ground deeper than our own Grand Canyon. But it's also long been the target of astronomers due to its high albedo, that is essentially the amount of light that this region of the moon is able to reflect, which is close to double the brightness of other features visible on the moon. And so in essence, for a long time, its brightness has attracted astronomers, but some over the years who've been looking at Aristarchus crater have also noticed something else rather interesting while viewing it. I personally have never seen this, but there are a lot of accounts going back centuries, in fact, of people saying that they've seen a bright flash from in the center of the Aristarchus crater, almost resembling a star as it twinkles in the night sky. Now, one of the earliest accounts of this that I've been able to find was published way back in 1836 by a Captain W. Smith, and writing a letter that he published in Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, he told of seeing a light that he said resembled a star of the 9th or 10th magnitude, and he said also appeared by glimpses, but at times was brilliant and visible for several seconds together. In his letter, Smith also said that there can be no doubt of this being the identical spot mentioned by Cassini, Sir William Herschel, and Captain Cater, and also that described by Dr. Maskelyne. Now, of course, if these sightings go all the way back to Cassini and Herschel, then that must indicate that people centuries ago had claimed that they'd seen a bright spot, something resembling a star-like flash emanating from the center of the Aristarchus crater. What in the world is that? Have they got a beacon up there? Was someone or something, at least as far back as 1836, but apparently much earlier, according to Smith's account there, was someone or something signaling back to Earth from up there on the moon, or was there something reflective? And if there was something reflective, what was that? Had someone put metal on the moon that far back? Where could that have come from? Well, sightings of this, what I've actually referred to over the years in articles I've done about it, as the Aristarchus anomaly, they have actually occurred in recent times too. If you look back in 1965 in the magazine Understanding, there was an article by a guy named Ron Emanuel in the November 1965 issue that also included a description of a single point of bright light that sort of resembled a star that was seen in the center of the crater. And in fact, I'll have a couple of articles that I've written about this, one fairly recently for the debrief, linked in the show notes for anybody who'd like to dig a little deeper into this. But the question of what might actually cause this sort of strange luminous phenomenon on the moon has long been a question that astronomers have asked. And it seems to be the case that there are some unique properties related to the Aristarchus crater and, more importantly, its mineral composition that might actually contribute to this. But more importantly, it's the exposure of those minerals in the uplift that's created by the impact event itself that actually created this crater. Because essentially when an impact strikes the moon, it almost liquefies the surface, if indeed the impact is of a significant enough magnitude. The behavior of the lunar regolith actually almost behaves more like a fluid. And citing NASA data, they say the energies of impacts are so high that rocks no longer behave as brittle solids. They essentially act like a deformable plastic. And this behavior of the moon's crust during the impact event causes the crater to rebound, driving up material from deep below the surface. And then there's a central peak that's formed in the middle of many lunar craters like this. But of course, if you look at images online of the Aristarchus crater, you'll essentially see what looks like a little mountain right there in the center, that primary peak. According to NASA, they say that in the case of the Aristarchus crater, the central peak contains rocks with three very different albedos. There's that word again, talking again about the reflectivity of these bright regions on the moon. But as the NASA fact sheet notes, as these materials erode out of the central peak, they slide downslope and they create these contrasting stripes. But the highest albedo material reflects about four times as much light as the lowest albedo rocks. Interesting, huh? Now, of course, I had wondered whether or not that alone could account for the mysterious Aristarchus anomaly. The fact that the albedo of that bright region near the center is four times as bright as everything around it. Is it just an optical illusion? Is that what's really going on right there? Well, according to this recent mineralogical data collected by the Chinese lunar probe, it turns out there might be some new data contained therein that could help explain all this, which is really exciting if you think about it. Now, in past studies, NASA has said that the high albedo material there in the center of the crater is most likely a common lunar rock type, which they call anorthosite. That's a material that's already known to form most of the lighter areas around the lunar crust. Darker areas, on the other hand, happen to be made of basaltic material. But another alternative actually involves silicic rock, something akin to granite, a silica-rich rock, which, of course, astronomers do know to form on the moon, but according to previous studies, we just don't know a whole lot about their origin and where exactly on the moon they're found. Well, in those recent samples collected by China's Chang'e-5 probe, it was found that silicon dioxide debris may have come from the Aristarchus impact crater. That's interesting to me because, again, if we have silicon dioxide debris recovered from the Aristarchus crater, it would appear to lend weight to that NASA speculation about one thing that could cause the high albedo in the Aristarchus crater being the presence of silicic rock, which along with things like pyroclastic glass that also forms on the moon, these might not only account for the high albedo, but they might also represent an area where there is a reflective quality on the surface of the moon that also might help account for the so-called Aristarchus anomaly. So there you have it. This might be the reason why people have seen a star-like or beacon-like flash of light from within the Aristarchus crater for centuries. Case closed, right? Well, that might be the case if it weren't for the fact that this is actually just one of the kinds of strange luminous phenomena that have been observed over the years in or around the Aristarchus crater. And at this point, I want to refer to an article I did years ago over at Mysterious Universe that talked a little about this, where I wrote that there were other strange transient lunar phenomena that would occasionally be reported around the Aristarchus crater. As an example, on October 13, 1959, E.H. Rowe in Devon, United Kingdom, was observing the moon at approximately 7 p.m. As he wrote, "While observing the moon with a 36-inch telescope, my attention was directed to the crater Aristarchus." Now, initially, what Rowe described seeing, what caught his eye, had just been this kind of brilliant white light, not unlike what other people had described, going all the way back to Herschel and Cassini. But then he said that there was something strange that he observed thereafter, and this is really the more relevant part. As he wrote, "I was surprised to see a delicate, yet bright reddish amber glow in or near Aristarchus clearly outlined against the white background. It was visible," Rowe said, "for only a few seconds. After it disappeared, no trace remained to show it had been there." Well, this would be only the first mention of a red or an amber-colored band or cloud or a haze of light that people would claim to see over or near the Aristarchus crater. In fact, 4 years after Rowe's first sighting, there was a month-long period where an entire group of astronomers at the Lowell Observatory tracked a series of bright red lights that they kept observing for close to a month around the crater Herodotus, which is actually just adjacent to Aristarchus, both of these craters toward the tip of what they call the Cobra Head, which is actually this ancient volcanic vent that scored the landscape and left this kind of a river-like formation. So you've got both those craters there. And between the two craters during this period, between October and November of 1963, these astronomers at the Lowell University continued to see these red lights that were moving around this region of the moon. Sometimes they described them as clustered in an oval formation along the south rim of the crater Aristarchus. In 1963, Sky and Telescope magazine chronicled this series of sightings, and it no doubt got the attention of other astronomers who also began to look into that region and see if they could see these weird red lights as well. And that's exactly what happened when an astronomer in Japan named T. Sato, based out of Hiroshima, said that he saw this phenomenon, again, just a month later,
and this sighting on the heels of similar sightings made by 7 astronomers who said that they watched a strange pinkish-colored light moving over the southern portions of Aristarchus. Here again, this group also said that they watched these pinkish lights move in the direction of the Herodotus crater nearby. But wait, there's more, because within 1 year of that sighting, then we had astronomers at the Goddard Space Flight Center who were also reporting seeing these colored bands of reddish light, and other colors in fact, over crater Aristarchus. In this case, Saul Gannat, who had at the time been the station manager there on site for the optical research facility at Goddard Space Flight Center, and also an electronic technician named Edwin Reed, said that they also saw these strange lights, and this is the account that appeared thereafter in Understanding, published later that year. Mr. Gannat said that through a 16-inch telescope, he and his electrical engineer colleague saw two distinct reddish bands over the southern part of the crater and a bluish band over the northern part. The bands were roughly parallel, and the reddish bands were of equal thickness, they said. About 4 or 5 miles was their estimate. The longest reddish band was about 35 miles in length. It was the most southerly of the three. The other reddish band just above it was only 2 or 3 miles away and about 30 miles long. Mr. Gannat said that, quote, up in the northern part of the crater, about 20 miles from the northern reddish band, was a bluish band about 15 miles long. All the bands ran an east-west direction, roughly parallel to each other. The colors were very prominent at first. The reddish bands were really red, and the other was quite blue. As time passed, the intensity of the colors weakened. Now, this is a little more difficult to explain than the so-called beacon there at the center of Aristarchus, although I would guess probably that these unique, colorful observations probably also have something to do with the mineral content there within the Aristarchus crater. According to another NASA fact page, they note that the area has long been known to be among the reddest spots on the moon. But of course, by that, they mean that its reflectance strongly increases from short to long wavelengths. Now, that said, relying on wide-angle camera images obtained by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter in recent years, there are really some excellent color images that have been collected in recent years that seem to show this area and might account for why some astronomers, especially viewing it through a telescope, have seen everything from reddish hues to bands of blue coloration. But one of the interesting things, too, about this is the fact that sometimes these splotches of color appear to move. So if it were solely something that was emanating from the ground, that wouldn't seem to necessarily be the case unless something in the ground, i.e. the mineral content in this region of the crater, is affecting the optical conditions, or maybe it's the other way around. The optical conditions are affecting the way that light is reflected off of those portions of the crater, and that, in effect, has caused astronomers to see strange coloration, little pinpoints of light from right there in the center of the crater, and all kinds of other things. But it is interesting that of all the places on the surface of the moon, that it would seem that this phenomena occurs almost exclusively right there around Aristarchus, or between Aristarchus and the Herodotus crater. But then again, we also have to take into consideration one final point here. It is the fact that the Aristarchus crater is always so bright and thereby often attracts the attention of astronomers. It's one of the most viewed locations probably anywhere on the moon that people have ever trained their telescopes on. And because of that, it actually makes sense that people would be seeing strange things in that region. More astronomers over the decades have spent time looking at it. So it may be the case that these kinds of optical effects can be seen elsewhere. And indeed, there may be a more down-to-earth, or at very least, down-to-moon explanation for strange lights, mysterious hazes, and splotches of red light seen moving around on this portion of the lunar surface. But when we come back here in a moment, we're going to shift our attention away somewhat from the transient form of lunar phenomena, although I think it might be worth kind of outlining exactly what we mean by transient lunar phenomena. A lot of astronomers look for that, but we're also going to look at some of the strange structural matters, features and other things seen on the moon that remain very curious right here on the Micah Hanks program. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. In pursuit of lunar mysteries, this week on the Micah Hanks program, glad as always to be your host, and of course, to be occupying your mind with the anomalous aspects of our existence. And of course, if you are enjoying this program and would like to show support for my efforts, but also get a little something to show for it, head on over to MicahHanks.com/podcast. You'll see in the upper right-hand corner of the page a link to X memberships. You can sign up today. And that's just $7 a month or $77 a year for the premium account. That's going to get you weekly additional editions known as the X Podcast. And of course, the monthly Enigmas specials. We'll be dropping an episode of that in the days ahead. But of course, this is always the best way to get the full story from yours truly, your friendly neighborhood podcaster, because you're only getting half of that story when you only listen to this podcast. There are additional shows that go out every single week and lots of happy subscribers going on many years, in fact, who have long supported my personal efforts. But of course, this kind of a job is only as fun as the people you surround yourself with. So definitely check out not only my work, but also the collaborations that my colleagues and I work on together over there at thedebrief.org. Tim McMillan, MJ Benias, Chrissy Newton, Christopher Plain, and lots of other fine folks and contributors who are bringing news of the very interesting kind to the masses on an almost daily basis over there. Once again, that's thedebrief.org. On the heels of that last segment, though, getting back into things here, I thought it might be apropos to discuss exactly what we mean about transient lunar phenomena, which is essentially what we were describing in that last segment. I'm reading from a fact page available at the website of Columbia University here, which says that transient lunar phenomena, or TLPs, are described as short-lived changes in the brightness of patches on the face of the moon. I mean, that's essentially exactly what we were describing with regard to the so-called Aristarchus anomaly. They last anywhere from a few seconds to a few hours and can grow from less than a few to 100 kilometers in size. Most instances of TLPs are described as increases in the overall luminosity of a spot on the moon. However, sometimes observers report a decrease in a region's brightness or even a change in its color to red or violet. Sound familiar? Reports of TLPs have described them as mists, clouds, volcanoes, among other provocative terms. Even today, they are poorly understood. However, our team, according to the Columbia University page, is attempting to remedy this. They say hundreds of amateur and professional astronomers have documented their observations of TLPs since the invention of the telescope. A number have been confirmed by multiple observers or even photographed. A few TLPs were even reported by Apollo astronauts as they orbited the moon. Can you imagine that? The physical mechanism responsible for creating a TLP, they say, is not well understood. Of the many theories proposed, we believe that they are the outcome of lunar outgassing, that is, gas being released from the surface of the moon. To learn more about the evidence supporting this hypothesis, they ask that you read scientific papers that they have linked in this page, and I'll actually have this linked in the show notes, because this is very interesting, but they also pose this kind of funny question, are TLPs real? I mean, people say that they see them, right? So you'd think that they are. But they note here that because the evidence for TLPs is almost entirely anecdotal and based on visual descriptions by observers, many scientists remain skeptical as to whether or not TLPs are real. We too were skeptical when we began our investigation of TLPs, but our statistical analyses suggest that most reported TLP events are real, even though there are some spurious reports. Our Lunar Monitor Project, as described on this page, is an attempt at gaining an objective database of these events through the use of modern technology and a systematic search. So long story short, what they're essentially saying is that because so few people report these things, they're so uncommon, and there are very few photographs of them, many astronomers would treat these TLPs, transient lunar phenomena, like UFOs. Well, they probably don't exist. But according to the research team there at Columbia University, there are too many people essentially who say they've seen these things. There are, in fact, far too many accounts going way back in time, like we heard about the Aristarchus anomaly, at least going all the way back to observers like Cassini and Sir William Herschel, that indeed, it seems pretty evident that something is happening up there on the moon and people are definitely seeing these things. But now, shifting gears away from the simple discussion of these kind of transient lunar phenomena, and instead toward what we might call more constant phenomena, structural things there on the lunar surface that are worthy of our attention. A particular favorite of mine of many years involves what are called the Blair Cuspids, and this is a series of alleged spires or features that were actually first photographed way back in 1966 by Lunar Orbiter 2.
And if we go all the way back to 1966, the Washington Post covered this in an article written by Thomas O'Toole on November 23rd of that year, where he described these features as the six mysterious statuesque shadows. And here's what he had to say. He said, quote, ranging from one to about 20 feet long to another as long as 75 feet, the six shadows were hailed by scientists as one of the most unusual features of the moon ever photographed. One scientist, he wrote, described the needle-like shadows as the moon's Christmas tree effect. Still another description called it the fairy castle effect. And meanwhile, on seeing the picture, one scientist wanted to call the region the moon's Valley of Monuments. According to the article, the region of the moon where the shadows turned up is just to the western edge of the moon's Sea of Tranquility. It is an area just north of the moon's equator, slightly to the east or right of center. The 1966 WashPro article went on to say that scientists said that they have no idea what is casting the shadows. The largest shadow is just the sort that would be cast by something resembling the Washington Monument, while the smallest is the kind of shadow that might be cast by a Christmas tree. Now again, when we think about the Washington Monument, what comes to mind for you? Yeah, something like an obelisk, right? An incredibly tall spire that casts a long shadow. And in fact, looking at some of these old NASA photos of these peculiar features, the Blair cuspids, that's exactly what they look like. And needless to say, it was a pretty fascinating discovery. Scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey also got involved, and they concluded that these elongated shadows were actually cast, quote, by rock piles ranging from 16 to 75 feet high. Further quoting one of the USGS scientists, Dr. Thor Carlstrom, Newsweek also weighed in on the matter, noting that, quote, they, the cuspids, might be blocks of material ejected from a crater by the impact of some object. Interesting theory, right? Something that actually was blasted up, and that they landed in their current position after a large impact event. Newsweek also noted that the rocks could have been volcanic material ejected through faults in the moon's crust, a view which adds to the impressive evidence already accumulated by Lunar Orbiter 1 that the moon has had the same turbulent geological past as the Earth. But then a final theory was put forward. The structures might also be the eroded cones of old volcanoes, not unlike the famous Devil's Tower out in Wyoming that I've been to the base of, and that in recent days I noticed Jeremy Corbell and Lou Elizondo apparently visited together. Talk about one big pile of mashed potatoes, huh? But as quoted by Dr. Carlstrom back in 1966, he said, any of these possibilities could conceivably be correct, and of course none of them have been confirmed. Well, sometime later, things really started getting interesting when on February 1, 1967, the LA Times ran an article citing the opinions of one William Blair, who at the time was an anthropologist and a member of the Boeing Company's biotechnology unit, who at the time stated that while the spires may not be the work of any transitory intelligence, they were nonetheless worthy of interest to scientists. Transitory intelligence? First, we were just talking about transient lunar phenomena. Now we have the possibility of transitory intelligence, which, again, in fairness, William Blair said they were not necessarily. But in a statement published by the LA Times, he did go on to say, and I quote, if such a complex of structures were photographed on Earth, the archaeologist's first order of business would be to inspect and excavate test trenches and thus validate whether the prospective site has archaeological significance. They went on to report, Blair says that when he went over the photo with a compass and protractor, he found that the spires formed a basic XYZ right-angle coordinate system, six isosceles triangles, and two axes consisting of 3 points each. The anthropologist also discovered in the photo, he says, what appeared to be a large rectangular-shaped depression or pit directly west of the largest spire, estimated to be as tall as 70 feet. Blair says the shadow cast by this depression seems to indicate four 90-degree angles and resembles the profile of an eroded pit structure. Apparently, Mr. Blair analyzed that photograph of these alleged lunar spires, referencing an occasion when he had once employed aerial survey maps while attempting to locate an archaeological site somewhere in the American Southwest, from which the result had been that Blair became proficient at spotting what appeared to be geometric patterns in earthen structures because, as he noted later, quote, except for primitive nomadic peoples, man tends to construct single and multiple structures in geometric forms. Well, that is fundamentally true. And even though the Blair cuspids may be a natural formation, when you have an anthropologist who has knowledge of these geometric forms looking at this site, he's saying, come on, look, this actually resembles the kind of thing you'd expect somebody to build. Well, needless to say, not everybody agreed with Dr. Blair. And in fact, the dissenting opinion on this matter was offered by Dr. Richard Shorthill, an expert on lunar topography with the in-house scientific research laboratory also there at Boeing, who said pick some lunar features at random, and you eventually will find a group that seems to conform to some kind of pattern. Now, to that point, and again, I'll have links to articles where you can see the images of these so-called spires, the Blair cuspids in question. You can see these for yourself. These are no random assortment of depressions or other normal features you'd see on the lunar surface. These actually are quite unlike anything else that you'd expect to see anywhere on the moon. So I'm not really sure, even though I would maintain that the likeliest explanation for the cuspids would indeed be that they are of natural origin, but they just happen to look really weird. But nonetheless, I would have to agree with Mr. Blair, who fired back at Mr. Shorthill, in saying, and I quote again, "If this same axiom were applied to the origin of such surface features on Earth, more than half of the present known Aztec and Mayan architecture would still be under tree and bush-studded depressions, the result of natural geophysical processes." Now, on that point, by the way, I should point out that just a few years ago, there were tremendous amounts of ancient Mayan archaeological ruins exposed, not by archaeologists going out there and doing excavations in the Yucatan. No, it was LIDAR imagery collected from satellites that revealed these archaeological features. We didn't even have an idea of the sprawling Mayan complexes that were hidden beneath the jungle growth until we applied LIDAR technology from satellites and we're like, oh my gosh, there's so much more down there than we realized. But of course, back when Mr. Blair was saying all of this in 1966, we didn't have LIDAR imagery, did we? Rather prescient, and I'll quote him again here, saying, "If this same axiom were applied to the origin of such surface features on Earth, more than half of the present known Aztec and Mayan architecture would still be under tree and bush-studded depressions, the result of natural geophysical processes." Now, of course, he was talking about the architecture that was known at that time, but today he's been proven to be essentially right. A whole lot more, probably more than half, that was unknown to us until we used LIDAR technology. Yeah, it remained hidden under what? Tree and bush. Incredibly prescient statement. And to which Mr. Blair added that, quote, "The science of archaeology would have never developed, and most of the present knowledge of man's physical evolution would still be a mystery." So in essence, in Blair's opinion, the objects were certainly of some significance to science, despite the resolute disagreement from his colleagues at Boeing. But now at this point, enter Len Fleming, a computer systems analyst in the Artificial Intelligence Department at Southwest Research Institute between 1987 and 1990, who would eventually also weigh in on the matter of the so-called Blair cuspids as well. Fleming comes out arguing that the cuspids were dismissed as a result of quote-unquote uncritical thinking. And rather than trying to split hairs over the low-resolution images that had been released by NASA back in 1966, no, he went back and he tries to find larger format 8x10 versions of those images that were taken by Lunar Orbiter 2. He says, okay, these are the images everybody's fighting about. We have better images. Let's go find them. Well, of that search, here's what Fleming wrote 3 decades later in 1996. He said, when the photograph was released, the NASA Public Affairs Office identified it according to a numbering system that has since become obsolete. So there was no way to authenticate the image or to access the photographic support data listing the sun angle at the time and place of the photograph. This information, Thorne wrote, on the illumination geometry is of critical importance in evaluating the validity of the official explanation of why the shadows were so long. With the help of Fran Ridge of the Lunascan project, Fran Ridge also a hero of mine, and keep in mind, a guy who in addition to the independent lunar analysis project known as Lunascan, is also the guy who maintains NICAP.org and thereby continues to provide a tremendous historical resource for UFO researchers. But indeed, Fran Ridge helped out, as well as Mike Lomax and the staff at the National Space Science Data Center. With their help, Fleming was able to determine the correct frame number in question and thus locate better quality negatives which depicted the so-called Blair cuspids. And in his original 1996 report on all this, which he titled The Blair Cuspids, A Mystery Revisited, Fleming described how he was able to determine the proper angle from which the sun illuminated these objects, which, of course, is very significant because that may help us understand exactly how tall these structures are, if indeed structures they may be, along with other supporting technical data. And here's what he had to say. He said, with the correct frame number, We were also able to quickly reference the photographic support data in the Lunar Orbiter 2 catalog to find the angle of sunlight illuminating the objects in the photo. The catalog data showed that the sun was in the east at an angle of 79.1 degrees from the lunar vertical, or 10.9 degrees above the lunar horizon. While this sun angle is in fact low, Thorne said, it is by no means low enough to support the claim that the shadows were cast by common boulders. From the support data, he said it was also determined that this region is located at lunar coordinates 15.5 degrees east by 5.1 degrees north. Now, equally intriguing had been the fact that by adjusting the contrast of the photo that depicted the area around the Blair cuspids, Thorne said that an unusually regular rectangular depression was found to exist very close nearby. Here's what he said about that, quote, when an unusual feature such as this trench is found in close proximity to other unusual features of an entirely different kind, such as the cuspids, it is reasonable to suppose that the possibility for an artificial origin of all the features is substantially increased. This is so because a common geological explanation is made more difficult, and an appeal to improbable coincidence becomes more necessary to support a natural origin for the disparate features. So long story short, none of this necessarily proves, without question, that these were artificial features. But Lan Thorne certainly seemed to be entertaining that idea on account of the fact that there were so many different factors that were piling up and pointing to there being something odd about these cuspids. Whether natural or manufactured, really, perhaps the Blair cuspids would make for a unique addition to any future exploration of the moon in the coming years. I would hope that if we actually are going to go back, as we see with the Artemis missions and other plans that NASA currently has on the table, I mean, the very first destinations we plan to visit should be the Aristarchus crater. We should go out there, we should examine that uplift, we should travel to the top of the peak and the center of the crater. We should try to find out if indeed there are reflective qualities due to the albedo or perhaps due to the pyroclastic glass that was produced during these ancient volcanic formations. Whatever it is that's producing light in the middle of that crater, we should really go up there and study it. And as far as these Blair cuspids, you know, if they are a natural formation, studying them is going to tell us a lot about the geological features of the moon. It's going to tell us an awful lot about how these kinds of unusual formations occur on a moon orbiting a planet like Earth. And in the future, it might also help us if we understand what the processes are that lead to the formation of anomalous-looking features like the Blair cuspids. It might help us to rule out other similar features we find on other more distant moons. If you think back, over the years, there have of course been the stories about strange things that have been seen on moons encircling planets like Mars, right? Especially on the Martian moon Phobos. And on that note, that actually brings to mind a fun audio soundbite, which I'd like to feature right now. And this is Buzz Aldrin talking about the Martian moon Phobos and the existence of an alleged monolith on that Martian moon. Here's what Buzz Aldrin had to say.
We can visit other people with their habitation. We can keep track. If there's something very important to be developed from the moon, I'm not sure what it is right now. And I sure think we should identify what it is for America to make such gross expenditures again for human habitation on the moon. We can help. We can join with. Together, we can explore the moon and develop the moon. We should go boldly where man has not gone before. Fly by the comets, visit asteroids, visit the moon of Mars. There's a monolith. They're a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? Who put that there? Well, the universe put it there. If you choose, God put it there.
And there you have it. The comment by Buzz Aldrin that really raised a lot of eyebrows. When they find out there's a monolith up there on the Martian moon Phobos, wait a minute. What's he talking about? The universe put that there, though, he says. If you will, God put that there. In other words, what Buzz Aldrin is saying, obviously, is that this was a natural feature. This structure, as he refers to it, and again, I've referred to the Blair cuspids on the moon, our moon, as structures, for lack of a better term, but indeed, Buzz Aldrin is saying, yeah, that was a natural feature, but it's one well worthy of study. It, in fact, is probably incumbent upon us as human beings capable of spaceflight and exploration of the cosmos to get up there, to look more closely, and to study phenomena, natural or otherwise, like this. And I would certainly think that it would be important for future lunar explorations to visit sites like Aristarchus Crater and the Blair cuspids and take a closer look. Yes, indeed, maybe the universe put those there, but that makes them no less enigmatic. All right, we'll wrap things up here in a moment when we return right here on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back as we explore lunar mysteries this week in this special edition of the Micah Hanks program. I thought it would really be worth mentioning the fact that over the years there have also been speculations about whether or not the moon that we all see in the night sky on any given night is actually the only moon orbiting Earth. Now, it is of course possible for there to be, much like transient lunar phenomena, it's possible for there to be transient objects that enter Earth's orbit for a time, and then maybe thereafter leave. And in fact, there's a name for these kinds of objects that might occupy a place in orbit around the Earth for a while and then leave. They would be called moonlets. But long before we recognized these as moonlets, there were many astronomers, amateur and professional, who asked the question, what if there is another object in orbit around Earth, and one that's much smaller than the moon that we all know and love, and perhaps that is lurking somewhere out there, a second natural satellite? You know, one of the earliest to propose this idea way back in 1846 had been Frederick Petit, director of the observatory at Toulouse, and one evening in that year he claimed that he made an incredible discovery. That's right, he said he saw a second moon in orbit around planet Earth. As the story goes, there were two observers there at the Toulouse Observatory that had claimed to observe this object initially. And then in the days that followed, there were additional, then believed, confirmations of the sightings of an object. These corroborating sightings occurred at Artanak later in March of that year. And so Petit really believed that by that time, there was good evidence that there was a second moon orbiting the planet. And he wasn't, in fact, the only individual who believed that he'd discovered evidence of a second moon somewhere in orbit around Earth. In fact, 2 decades later, a Canadian weatherman by the name of E. Stone Wiggins, a fellow who in his day was somewhat notorious, also came forward with similar claims that he had found evidence of a second moon, this in 1882, although he didn't start publicizing the theory until around 2 years later, and it was many more years thereafter before it really began to reach critical mass. But earlier in May of 1882, Wiggins and many other commentators had weighed in on the fact that there was an unexpected lunar eclipse that occurred, and Wiggins thought that this was proof positive for the existence of another moon in orbit around Earth. How else, in other words, could an eclipse like this occur unexpected unless there were another object that were actually eclipsing the sun? Well, by 1907, the June 12th edition of the Edmonton Bulletin featured an article all about Wiggins and his discovery, and this is how it read. Professor E. Stone Wiggins, who some years ago was famous throughout Canada as an authority on weather problems, but who of late years has preserved a dignified silence on the great topic of perennial interest, has at least been induced to explain to a waiting public the wherefore of this long lingering of winter in the lap of spring. So in other words, winter was lasting a little longer than expected in the year in question, and people were coming to Mr. Wiggins and saying, "What gives?" And here's what he had to allot. He said, his explanation, published recently as a novel and original one, namely that there are two moons in the sky. He premises his explanation by stating that the sun has nothing to do with the case. The prevailing cold weather, he says, must be due to a planetary attraction, for it is general all over the globe. In 1882, according to Wiggins, I discovered another moon. It is now at that point of its orbit nearest the Earth and is producing all the aforementioned phenomena in the Earth's atmosphere. I knew this moon existed, he said, because our visible moon showed a disturbing force in her revolutions around the Earth, for which astronomers could not account. Then in 1884, I published a letter in the New York Tribune claiming the discovery, giving the evidence of trustworthy persons in Michigan who declared to me that the sun was eclipsed on May 16th of that year, the sky being perfectly cloudless, and when our visible moon was in another quarter of the heavens, and therefore could not possibly eclipse the sun. Now, that's an interesting point all unto itself, I'll interject here. What exactly had been the object that eclipsed the sun on May 16th of 1884. Admittedly, I do recall there being some kind of an explanation for this anomalous eclipse, but nonetheless, it slips my mind at the moment. But here is what Mr. Wiggins thought it was. He said this dark moon, again, believing that there was a second moon somewhere in orbit around Earth, has an immense carbon atmosphere in which the sun develops little or no light, but it has often been seen by persons who happen to be in the range of incidence of its reflected light. Well, Wiggins went on to cite additional unusual phenomena as further evidence of his idea of this second moon out there in orbit around Earth. And then on September 27, 1886, an unusual story appeared in the Toronto Globe, this also describing a peculiar green crescent moon, or at least, according to some observers, what looked like one. According to the account, a green crescent moon of the most brilliant yet delicate shade was recently seen in New Zealand. The phenomenon was visible for only half an hour. It has since been seen in North America, but each time, only about 29 minutes. Yeah, 29 minutes and probably right after sundown, while looking out over the ocean horizon. Yeah, this sounds to me an awful lot like, rather than a green crescent moon, what is known instead as the green flash. It's actually the refraction of sunlight through the atmosphere which causes a greenish, actually less like a crescent moon, and really, if anything, almost more shaped like a flying saucer hovering out there over the horizon. It will appear on many a clear night when one is overlooking the ocean shortly after sundown. But, of course, to folks who didn't have a full understanding of these kind of phenomenon would likely have thought that that so-called green flash was actually a green crescent moon. But then by 1907, Wiggins was still building on this claim, now adding additional testimony from a German scientist, Georg Waltemath, who in 1898 also claimed to have observed a second moon through his telescope and even calculated the object's orbit and motions. As Wiggins had suggested, Waltemath described the object he observed as being too dark to reflect enough light to become visible to the naked eye, and that the moonlet could only be seen through a telescope. Now, what's really interesting is that around the time that Waltemath claimed that he was observing this dark object that could only be seen through a telescope, and keep in mind this was reported in 1907, but again, Waltemath's calculations based on observations apparently going all the way back to 1898, what did this coincide with? That's right, 1896, 1897, 1898 was around the same time that there were a lot of sightings of alleged airships in the skies over North America, beginning in California and then gradually moving to the east and culminating in crazy stories along the lines of the crash of one of these objects down there at Aurora, Texas, and the recovery of the body, the charred remains, as it were, of the spaceman pilot who was buried there at the Aurora Cemetery, which I've actually gone to and visited more than once, being the dedicated Fortean that I am. Waltemath and Wiggins' observations, however, of a second moon were never confirmed, and hence the storied search for Earth's second satellite never really came to fruition. But, as an afterthought, I'll add that back during the 1950s, when the flying saucer craze was really taking root in the American consciousness, researchers like Donald Kehoe were convinced that sightings of possible moonlets that were actually being detected by the likes of Clyde Tombaugh, discoverer of planet Pluto, and others, were indeed not natural satellites or moonlets, but actually were a mothership from which flying saucers were being dispatched to planet Earth. And when you go back and you read Kehoe's book, Flying Saucers from Outer Space, he so much as says so. Whatever these objects are that are being detected in Earth orbit, these things must be the source of the flying saucers so many now say that they're seeing. And in truth, if indeed there were objects of mysterious provenance that were being observed by astronomers in Earth orbit around that time, keep in mind, back in the days before the launch of Sputnik, well, that definitely says something, because one has to ask what those objects were. Sure, maybe it's possible that an asteroid or other space object could enter a temporary orbit around planet Earth, and somehow eventually escape Earth's gravitational field and not actually be pulled toward it and burned up in the atmosphere like other asteroids or fireballs, not unlike the one seen over Texas last night. Yeah, maybe it's possible that an asteroid or other object could enter a temporary orbit and thereby become a second, albeit much smaller, moon in orbit around our planet. But if it weren't a natural object, then of course naturally, the other question remains. What else could it possibly be? And is it entirely too crazy to suppose that there is a chance that some strange objects observed in space, especially prior to the launch of satellites like Sputnik during the Cold War era space race, is it crazy to assume that there might have been some other objects in orbit around Earth? You know, there are actually scientists right now who are looking at these possibilities and going back over historical sky surveys collected back prior to the launch of Sputnik and looking for the telltale signatures of satellites, metallic satellites in orbit around Earth that could not possibly have been satellites we actually put up there. What would that mean? Well, of course, the implication is that if there were ever evidence of satellites found in orbit around Earth prior to the launch of Sputnik by the Soviets, then at least it leaves open the possibility that somebody put satellites in orbit around Earth before we actually had the ability to do so. In other words, maybe somebody was watching us. And following that very line of logic in the days ahead, researcher Beatrice Villarroel will join me here on the Micah Hanks program to talk about the citizen science initiative she is currently undertaking to look for that very sort of evidence. As always, needless to say, there's a lot to look forward to in the days ahead right here on the Micah Hanks program, which you can find on podcasting apps everywhere and via our station affiliates, the UNX Radio Network. Hey, tell your friends about it. And in the meantime, you can also follow me at MicahHanks.com, online, on Twitter, at MicahHanks, and of course, the journalistic contributions of yours truly and many others over at TheDebrief.org. I hope to see some of you guys in the days ahead at the Cape Girardeau event. You can find online at Cape-Events.com. That'll be the final word for this week's edition of the podcast. As always, thanks for being here, you guys. I'll catch you next time, and in the meantime, on behalf of yours truly, Micah Hanks, stay strange out there.